Previously on Willing to Adapt.
I think this is the episode we're going to have the most tangents on.
We are.
So today we're going to be talking about Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Or in America,
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Because yeah. Americans apparently are not smart enough to understand what the Philosopher's Stone was.
Harry Potter was like, I really wish I could have gone to Hogwarts. And like, I really wish like I had magic and all that stuff. When I was getting closer to 11, part of me really thought, maybe I'll get a letter. Like, you know, the logical part of me is like, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But the other part of me, the imaginative one, was like, I really hope I get a letter. I'm almost 11. when people tell me they got placed in Slytherin, I always think, oh yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense for you. And then my second thought is, oh no.
Hagrid is talking about
Hagrid.
Yes, my daughter has corrected me so many times on that. Hagrid is...
Hagrid!
I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
All right, so let's just jump into this. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, or Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the movie.
The movie.
Okay, so I think we both mentioned when we first watched the movie, which is basically when it first came out.
In the theaters? Yep. Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I think we're on the same page.
I know.
That's cool.
It is.
We were definitely different walks of life at that time, but that's fine.
Yeah, I don't remember even...
I kind of wish you could have grown up with it as a kid. It hits you differently.
I'm sure it does, because like growing up, unfortunately, there's a lot of 80s stuff that I didn't get to enjoy as a kid because my dad, remember, I think I've told you in a previous podcast
stuff that I got to enjoy.
You did, but I got to enjoy it later in life because like I think I had mentioned in a previous podcast, our listeners remember, that my dad would bring home videos from the library and stuff, and so unless he exposed it to us that way or unless we watched it on Channel 5 and Channel 13, KCT was Channel 28.
We did this every time.
Anyway,
doesn't matter.
And KTLA. So, yeah, and so unless it was, I experienced it that way. So I'm thinking of like the Goonies or a lot of
But you didn't watch the Goonies.
I didn't watch it until I was an adult.
I remember we talked about that too.
And the same thing with a lot of those teen movies.
John Hughes
movies. Yeah, I didn't experience those until I was older. I watched bits and pieces as they were on TV. So I feel like there wasn't a lot for me in my era, like franchise-wise. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really hit until the 90s. And I will say though,
the 90s were fun.
The 90s were. And the late 90s in particular were, I was leaving my teenage years, entering my early adult. And so, a lot of early 20 year olds, you either have those who just want to be, and I'm using adult very loosely, you know, they basically are out there living life, partying, drinking, sleeping around, doing whatever they're doing. For me, I was with the other crowd where they're kind of reliving their childhood a little bit. So the 90s for me, like...
I think I was that route a little bit too.
Yeah.
Like I definitely had about a year or two where I was kind of going a little crazy, but I feel like when I was in my early 20s, that was like a revisiting my childhood.
Nostalgia. I think it was a very big nostalgia.
But also because you have that freedom now.
And you have money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like for me, it was Pokemon and very much Harry Potter. Harry Potter for me, I got to experience the movies. I think I took my sister, not my daughter. She wasn't born yet. I think I took my sister with me to go see the movies. I can't remember.
And you loved them.
I did. And she, so I got to live vicariously through her.
Oh, because she's younger?
Because she's younger. Yeah. She was born in 87.
Okay.
So I don't know where that would
and
make
you
her.
Were born.
Just switch those two numbers around.
I was waiting. I was trying to catch you, but I couldn't stop smiling.
So she was, I think, in high school or middle school. I can't remember. I don't remember where she was. No, if I was in high school, she would have been younger. So I got to watch, like, she got into the books, my little sister. And I got to kind of live vicariously through her and see it, how a child experienced Harry Potter as it was coming out.
There's definitely a lot of things that I was privy to because of my sister. Because she was 10 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
And in some ways, sometimes I felt like a third parent because of the age difference. And I think she matured a lot faster because she grew up with a lot of older people. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that I was aware of that I wouldn't normally have been aware of at my age because she was so much younger.
Oh, okay.
Like whole TV shows and movies and things.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think it makes it nice when you have someone to kind of vicariously, I mean, once you become an adult. That's part of...
That's usually why people have children.
it is. No, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I've shared it with how I've loved... My favorite memories are experiencing things with my daughter. You know, whether it was the Star Wars and watching it in order and everything like that. And I, unfortunately, like I said, I kind of
brought... You watch it with new eyes.
You do. And I wish I would have brought Harry Potter... besides the movies. I know she grew up watching the movies, but I think this is the one franchise where I didn't introduce it to her in time. I waited a little too long. So I was there, I think, opening week for the movie, if not opening day. I can't remember if I waited in line to see it or not. I think I went to maybe like the first weekend when it opened. But I still remember. I mean, it wasn't...
It's so good.
It is, but it wasn't. It was like it was up there, but it's not. Like there's some movies when I remembered just being in the theater and being amazed. I think for this one, not being like amazed like when I was watching Jurassic Park for the first time, but I remember going into the theater and just seeing the book come alive. So it wasn't necessarily one of the grandest, but it was amazing to see. It was amazing enough to be able to see the visually everything kind of that was in my head come alive in the screen. So that was the first time I saw the movie.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump into this. So we said the movie is a 2001 fantasy film. It's directed by Chris Columbus. It was produced by David Heyman. And it's from a screenplay by Steve Kloves and obviously based on the novel by J.K. Rowling. And it blew up, like, that series and everything beyond. The film stars Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter, with Rupert Grint as Ron Weasley, and Emma Watson as Hermione Granger, and a crazy amount of famous British actors and actresses. You know, you get Maggie Smith, Robbie Coltrane, John Hurt, so many. Richard Harris. I don't have time to go through everybody. Alan Rickman, you know.
Isn't Richard Harris, though, in the later ones?
No, Richard Harris is Dumbledore in the first two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So many big names. Like, you can't go, like, 10 minutes and at any point in this movie without another big name.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the things. J.K. Rowling specifically only wanted British or Irish actors or actresses. She didn't want any American. She wanted to keep it very British.
Yeah, it worked.
Which I agree. I think it's fine.
I will say, though, the actors... So, I don't know if you knew Warwick the actors. Davis. Yes, Warwick Davis. I don't know if you knew the actors before they were in Harry Potter. For the most part, that was my introduction to a lot of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
There were a couple that I recognized. Like, but I was also so young that it was hard. My dad had Murder by Death recorded on a VHS tape.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, it's so funny. I need to show you a flip later. It's a Neil Simon made-for-TV movie. It's so funny. It's got a lot of big names in it, too. Maggie Smith was in that. And it's from, like, the late 70s, so she's much younger. But I can't remember. I think I saw both of them around the same time, but because she looked different, like, I didn't associate it right away. But, yeah, I think I'm the same. There's a lot of these actors and actresses that this was the first time for, I think, a lot of people that we were introduced
to
these actors.
Unless you were like my dad watching BBC stuff. That was on American TV.
I got into a lot of BBC stuff when I was like in middle school, high school. So the Warner Brothers Pictures bought the film rights to the book in 1999 for a reported £1 million or $165 million. The production began in the United Kingdom in 2000, with Columbus being chosen to head up the film from a very, it says a short list of directors, mm-hmm. but then in interviews, Chris Columbus said that his agent said that there was like 50.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, I'm sure that dwindled fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Steven Spielberg was one of the top ones, including Rob Reiner. But they either weren't chosen or like Steven Spielberg went off to do something else. Like he did AI, artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. which makes sense. That was like a passion thing between him and Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense. It did remarkably well. It still does amazingly well. It was a critical and commercial success. It grossed $974 million at the worldwide box office during its initial run, and over a billion with subsequent releases. It became the highest grossing film of 2001.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's a lot more, but I don't want to go too much in depth on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I came across on many different sources is how J.K. Rowling would be like one of the richest people mm-hmm. right now, except that she keeps losing her status because she keeps giving so much of her money to charities.
Oh, wow. That's funny. That's yeah. cool.
It's like, you really could be on the top list, but you keep giving so much away, which I'm like, good for you. One of the things I want to mention very quickly, just because it makes a lot of sense for a lot of the artistic choices mm-hmm. for the movie.
Yeah.
When Columbus came onto the job and he went to go meet with J.K. Rowling, she wasn't sure about him because he was not her first choice.
Oh, okay.
But he really wanted to do it, and I'll go into him a little bit. But he went and he pitched his vision of the film for 2 hours to her, stating that he wanted the Muggle scenes to be bleak and dreary, but those set in the Wizarding World to be steeped in color, mood, and detail. Mm. He took inspiration from David Lean's adaptations of Great Expectations from 1946 and Oliver Twist from 1948, wishing to use that sort of darkness, that sort of edge, that quality to the cinematography, while being further inspired by the color designs for Oliver, the musical from 1968, and The Godfather from 1972.
Okay.
And if you look at those movies, it makes sense.
Yeah, I've seen Great Expectations and Godfather.
Mm-hmm. But if you watch the movie Harry Potter, mm-hmm. it actually makes a lot of sense because a lot of the wizard, their like aesthetic mm-hmm. is very Dickensian.
Like, you're right. Now mm-hmm. that it took me a second, like you look at, I had to kind of go through it in my like head, but you're right.
Alley and even when
diagonally.
Yes. That only makes sense if you've read or seen the second one.
Yes.
But it's very Dickensian. It's at least for the first few movies.
First two.
Well, the two for sure. Well, then they switched directors.
Yeah, so. I know. Important.
I liked Alfonso Cuarón.
I did too, but
there is, I can back up him mm-hmm. because I like a lot of what he does. He definitely breaks some rules that I was not, I didn't like he did, but one of the things I did not like was how he wanted it to be so much more casual.
That's what I didn't like.
But one of the things I'm going to talk about a little bit is apparently in the books for Harry Potter, mm-hmm. It was more casual. And then they changed it in adapting.
Really? I didn't.
Yeah, and it was confusing for me because I'm coming more from the movies when I think about, like, there's definitely things about the books when I'm imagining it in my head that are just me.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that the book describes that I just automatically think of the movie.
Yeah.
Like when the movie, in the book, when it says, you know, they bought their wizarding robes. Mm-hmm. Or they were wearing their wizarding robes in school, mm-hmm. or like things like that. I just think, you know, the uniforms.
Yeah.
But she didn't mean it that way. Like, apparently when she was talking to Christopher Columbus and other people, the robes were on top of their normal clothes.
Yeah, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and so it wasn't a uniform.
Oh.
It was, like, the uniform would have been the cloak and the hat that they wore.
Okay.
But everything underneath would have been their normal clothes.
Interesting.
And it was just, she never, like, flat out states that.
Yeah.
But that's what she had intended. And then when they adapted for the movie, they wanted to go for a much more British look, and they wanted to go for a much more timeless look. Oh. And so they leaned into that, like, British, like, school uniform look.
Oh, okay.
And that way that distinguished it from the Muggle world more, and that way they were also able to differentiate the houses, mm-hmm. which is not in the book. They don't differentiate by wardrobe in the books.
Which actually makes sense, because for the first time when I was watching the movie, and how they arrive not being sorted,
mm-hmm.
and they bring what they bought.
I've always wondered that.
How did they have the right colors if they didn't know what house they were going to be in? Yeah, yeah. That popped into my mind for the first time.
They buy all their wizarding robes and everything while they're in Diagon Alley.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know what house they're going to be in. So part of me was like, well, it's magic. They can just transfigure it, and then it changes, you know?
Which they haven't learned yet.
Yeah, because, But it's Hogwarts, you know?
Yeah.
You can always just go back to, but it's magic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because if you watch, they show up to Hogwarts, I think it's just black ties.
Yeah, they're all the
same. And then once they're sorted, it changes.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something I used to think about. And then when I saw that interview, I was like, okay, now it makes sense. But, yeah. But you can see where he got a lot of that Dickensian look from. And he was definitely trying to go for that really timeless, set apart. Like, I think even some of, like, the Muggle clothes they wear in the movie are even kind of timeless. In that the movie itself doesn't feel that dated.
Except for the graphic.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. But I know that they, yeah.
Did you watch
a little bit about. Okay.
Well, then let's just say that real quick because we're out of the way. You want to explain it? Because you watched it, too.
Well, no, I don't know if we watched the same thing.
But I think we did.
It was in regards... So here they were just talking about more along the lines of, I mean, they used kind of the CGI, I guess, that they had available at the time. And a lot of it, they just improved with each movie based as the technology got better or as they were able to figure out how to do things better, basically. And so when I watched the first one, again, certain scenes don't age well. And it's like they look blatantly fake. I mean, I'm sure they looked that way back then, but I just didn't really think about it. So I think the big one is the troll fight.
I didn't notice it back then.
Yeah, I don't remember noticing it
either. I really did not notice it until much later in life.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for sure, they do talk about how... I mean, to be fair, I got a little distracted. Did you mention how they put off those scenes to the last... minute, and so they didn't have as much time to actually...
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, in a lot of interviews, Chris Columbus and other people, like the mm-hmm. producer, stated because of the scheduling issues they had with the film, they had to film all the Quidditch scenes, like, almost last.
Yeah.
And because of that, they didn't take into account they would have a lot less time in post
mm-hmm.
to work on the CGI and other things.
Yeah.
And so they took that into consideration when they did the second movie, and they filmed a lot of the Quidditch scenes early.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot more time in post to make it look really good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I watched as he talked about that.
And he said specifically that was one of the things he was not happy about in the film, that he did not have more time for that.
And I think the only two places it really is evident is the trolls fight scene mm-hmm. and then the Quidditch match.
Yeah. I think the one thing I thought about in regards to that is... you have to take into consideration what kind of TV you're watching it on, too.
Oh.
A lot of modern TVs make a lot of old CGI look really bad.
Okay, yeah.
If you watch, like, an older television, like, maybe not even, like, 10 years old,
mm-hmm.
compared to, like, a much more modern one, it doesn't look as bad.
Okay.
I think a lot of it has to do with the quality now and, like, the ultra-high depth.
That makes sense because up until a couple months ago, all I had was the 32-inch... Mm-hmm. 1080. And so, I mean, honestly, most movies looked fine to me. Now that I'm watching things on a 4K, I've started picking up a lot more of that on the older films.
Yeah, there was a movie, I don't know if you've seen it or I've told you, back around the same time period, I think maybe around 2001, maybe 2004, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. There was a movie that came out, and it didn't do super well, but I love it, called Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow.
I've always wanted to watch it.
Oh, it's so good.
I have yet to watch it, though. Yeah.
It's like, before we knew what this was, it was basically diesel punk.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was like Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not the movie, but...
No.
Yeah, in the same vein as how they got Star Wars and they got Indiana Jones mm-hmm. and stuff, it was like an homage to like a 1930s or 40s.
Yeah. Like, no, because there was a video game on the original Xbox that was the same idea. You basically flew biplanes, you were pirates, and mm-hmm. it was the same idea. Yeah. Tailspin. And,
yeah, sure. Oh, I like Tailspin.
Yes.
It was such a cool concept.
Uh-huh.
But It's the idea, and it was based on like real things from the time. Yeah. It was basically an homage, like I said. But it's set in like an alternate like 1939.
Okay.
And the only way you know it's 1939 is because they're watching Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
In it. And I think at one point there's like a date somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely meant to be an alternate time period.
Yeah.
Where they have a lot more technology than they really had at the time and stuff. But like all the aesthetic is still there. But they make a lot of style choices in the movie, like you've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movie heavily relies on CGI. For all the stylizing and including things like the robots and things like that. So in the behind the scenes, a lot of times the actors are just running on green screens the whole time. Like very rarely are they actually in real sets.
Yeah.
But it looks gorgeous. Like I think for the time, like even when I was younger, there were a couple scenes where you watch it, you're like, okay, it looks slightly cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it was still like young CGI.
Yeah.
But I will say there's also an argument to be made that modern CGI is also terrible too.
Yeah, sometimes it is.
But I've noticed, depending on what TV I watch it on, it looks horrible.
Mm.
Like I've watched it on older televisions and it looks gorgeous and it looks amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'll watch like on my phone and it looks fine. But I've watched it on like super modern TVs and it's like almost unbearable to watch.
Wow.
Because it really brings out the imperfections and the cheesiness and stuff like that.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. And so that's why, like, even when you go to like Costco or somewhere where they have like really high def televisions,
yeah,
it looks so clear that it looks fake.
Oh, wow.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. No, I have. When you kind of walk by the different TVs and even though they're all supposed to be the same, they all look very different. Yeah. I've noticed that.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that plays into it. But there are definitely times where you watch it, like in the Quidditch scene, where you're like, oh, okay, that's a CGI character. But, you know, I think for a kid, you don't notice it as much either, though.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to say very briefly is how much involvement J.K. Rowling had in the creative process for the movie.
Yeah.
Which I think for good reason, because, like, she had fully fleshed it all out and was still working on all the books, like we said. And nobody really seemed to mind. Like, I really, really liked her input and really respected her. And even, like, Chris Columbus, when he came on board, said he really wanted to make sure that he took it seriously and he didn't really want to change anything. He wanted to, like, basically, like, a love letter to the book. Like, he wanted to keep it as accurate as possible.
Yeah.
And he's gotten some flack from some people. I think there's some people out there who say, I don't want to just watch a page-to-page.
Mm-hmm.
Like remake, which I will say he did not do a page-to-page remake.
No, there was a lot of changes.
But I think it's a very good adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
But he said because it meant so much to him that he wanted to make sure like it was something that like his daughter essentially would say, this is what I imagined.
Okay.
Yeah. But I wanted to say real quick that Steve Kloves, who wrote the screenplay, he said that it was tough to adapt the book. He said it did not lend itself to adaptation as well as he said the other books in the series.
Yeah.
Which makes some sense, I think, because I think there's more style choices in the other books.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he was really nervous when he first met Rowling. He did not want her to think that he was going to just like destroy her baby. And it's funny because Rowling actually had admitted later on that she was really ready to hate him. But she recalled her initial meeting with him. The first time she said, the first time I met him, he said to me, you know who my favorite character is? And Rowling thought, you're going to say Ron. And I know you're going to say Ron. But he said Hermione. And she said that she just kind of melted. And in separate interviews, she has said that Hermione is basically a perfected version of her.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
And so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh. Do you want to add anything to that before I talk about Chris Columbus a bit?
Nope.
All right. So Warner Brothers originally had considered making the entire Harry Potter film franchise as, get this, it's funny, as a set of computer animated movies.
Wow.
Or attempting to combine several of the novels into a single movie. Similar to how they did the movie version of A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Okay.
And the studio's reasoning mainly had to do with the concern over the rapid aging of child actors and actresses, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If the production ran too long on any of the movies, or if production was delayed between sequels, the leading actors and actresses might have to be recast. The author, J.K. Rowling, vetoed both the ideas. The studio decided to instead to produce all 8 movies back to back.
Oh, wow.
So the same actors and actresses could play their roles in every movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in interviews, I think you saw some of that too. Chris Columbus was saying he was already doing the preliminary work for mm-hmm. Chamber of Secrets while he was still in post on the first one.
Okay. I think I remember seeing that.
And so the impression I get from a lot of the actors, especially on the movie, is it was always like go, go, go.
Yeah.
For like 8 plus years of their life.
Mm-hmm.
It was because they couldn't waste any time.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of the reason, we might come back to this later on, that's part of the reason why Chris Columbus left.
Because
he could have kept going. Like, mm-hmm. nobody kicked him out or anything. Like, they had fully intended, and he had fully intended to do all 8.
Oh, wow.
But he was such a family man.
Mm-hmm.
The producer of the film, I think, said that he had actually, he would fly to his family in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
From England every weekend.
Wow.
Just to be with them, because he placed that much importance on family time.
Yeah.
Which I'm all for. I think that's amazing.
Yeah. That's admirable.
So they said that he would always leave on Friday to go home, and then he'd be back on Monday for more filming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But, you know, his daughter was growing up, and he wanted to spend more time with her. And so he said, I can't keep making these movies back to back like this and miss out on her life.
Yeah.
And so he basically stopped filming them as a director to be a part of his family.
Okay.
Which I think is a very noble thing. I think it must be really tough to give up, like, your project and your baby and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In a way, that was his other child.
Right? I know. It's...
I had always wondered why he didn't continue on, so that makes sense.
A very noble reason, I think.
Yeah.
I feel bad, I though, 'cause I do like the third movie.
Yeah, I do too.
And we'll talk about that one for sure another time. There are aspects of the other movies I like, but compared to the first 2 movies, the first 2 I think are some of the best ones.
I have to agree.
And I really want to know what Chris Columbus would have done for the rest of them.
Yeah.
Because you know they would have looked different. And you know that it would have just felt different. Because I think Chris Columbus can handle darkness very well.
Because
you see a bit of that in Chamber of Secrets.
Yeah.
And I think he could have handled the dark aspect very well. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious. Just like I really want to know what J.J. Abrams' original idea for the new Star Wars trilogy would have been.
Oh.
Like if they didn't replace them for the episode 8.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Chris Columbus. One of Chris Columbus's daughters had trouble reading until she read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in 2 days, apparently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it opened her eyes to the world of books. After reading Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, she asked Columbus to make movies out of them. But there were 50 other directors already interested, it says. Columbus fell in love with the first 2 books, too. He had said originally he didn't want to read them because they were just kids' books. And then after he read them, he's like, oh, no, these are more than kids' books.
Yeah.
And he said he sat down with Warner Brothers saying how obsessed he was with making the film more than anything else. Columbus asked to be the last director Warner Brothers saw, which took about 10 days. Columbus stayed up until 3 a.m. rewriting the script each day. It was already a good script, but Columbus wanted to talk about the visuals. He told Warner Brothers he had rewritten the script for free, and that made an impression on them because that didn't happen in Hollywood, where they have to pay for everything. Because Columbus had done that without any pressure from Warner Brothers, it made the difference, and after subsequent meetings, and 5 weeks later, he got the job.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
He really wanted it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he said he, like, fell in love with it, like, it was a passion for him.
That's cool.
Oh, yeah. I will say it was very strange reading this book for the first time in probably over a decade. One of the things I really like about this podcast is I feel like it's like reopening my eyes to things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also giving me excuses to read and watch things that I probably would have told myself I don't have time for that right now.
Yeah.
There's definitely movies and books that like I've wanted to reread or rewatch or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because like I'm in school and I work and stuff, I keep thinking, you know, I can't do that right now.
Yeah.
Like,
that's just a waste of time. But, you know, now I have a reason, right?
Yep.
And so this was one of those times. I'd been telling myself I wanted to reread the Harry Potter books, like, as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt really weird because I know everything that's going to happen in the series.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it would be like to be exposed to all the magic and the fascinating elements of the Wizarding World for the first time.
Mm.
I feel like it'd be very different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The mystery's gone, but I still really enjoyed it, but for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. I appreciated it more.
Okay.
Because like I said, you can really see how she had fleshed out this world, and she really knew where she was going to take these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And like she would like very casually just drop things in that seemed like they meant nothing, but yeah. then like 5 books later, like really meant something.
Mm-hmm.
And like she really planned it. Which I love and I appreciate. What was it like reading it after all these years? Or I guess rewatching it too?
I mean, considering I watched the movie every on the, well, we were talking about the Family Channel or whatever, the Fox Family Channel.
ABC Family.
ABC Family, that's what it was. ABC Family. And so I want to say I've seen this movie a lot. So for me, it's very much a part of like culture. It's like, unfortunately, I think, not that I'm oversaturated with it, but it's like a lot of the other movies that franchises that I like, where I've seen it so much, the wonder and amazement is kind of gone. And now I just appreciate it because it's a lot of nostalgia and, I don't know. I think the one thing that was different this time around is because I had read the book, or I was reading the book, I read the book first, and then I watched the movie. It allowed me to see the differences for the first time that I hadn't really paid attention to. I think I had read them on the website, like as they were happening, or as the movies were coming out, and you know how people would post websites and they'd show the difference between the two. This was the first time where I actually sat and I just read the book and I just watched the movie, and it was interesting to see it, the side by side comparison. That was different this time around. But I still enjoyed the movie as much as I did the first time I saw it.
I think when I was talking about the book kind of planting seeds
mm-hmm.
for later books, like one of the things I think the book definitely does a better job of that than the movies do. But that's
definitely.
Obviously because she knew.
Yeah.
And she was only letting the filmmakers into what they needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
But like one of them in the book that I kept being reminded of is, you know, like, Hagrid was expelled from mm-hmm. Hogwarts. That plays heavily into the second one.
Yeah.
It also mentions how Harry thinks Snape can read minds. Very casually, he says it. But you look at it, like the character mm-hmm. and stuff, and that becomes another major plot point in the fifth book when he has to teach Harry occlumency.
Occlumency, that's what it's called, yeah.
Yeah, but like when he talks about it in the book, there's a moment where like the way that Snape reacts and stuff, I was like, oh, maybe they are foreshadowing that.
Could be. Yeah, yeah, most likely.
Just like, there was a moment where I was thinking, am I looking too much into this? But then the more I looked at interviews with J.K. Rowling and like with other people, like the director and stuff, the more I realized, oh no, she really actually thought about all this.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Quirrell actually tells Harry that Snape hates him because Snape went to school with Harry's father.
Yeah.
And the two of them hated each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Dumbledore goes a bit more in depth on that. But and then I think the one that I liked is the book actually near the end. It mentions that Dumbledore knows a lot more and that he just won't divulge yet.
Yeah.
And he's working behind the scenes towards something. Like you really get that impression in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more than in the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Yeah.
In the movie had this feeling of like a lot of this was just happening and nobody was really aware of it happening.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the book, you get this impression, especially by the end, that Dumbledore really knew what was going on the whole time.
Oh, yeah. No.
And that he had been kind of working behind the scenes, like giving Harry the invisibility cloak, not once, but twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like he came back and he knew Harry was going to go after Voldemort, like, and all that. Like,
yeah, they show he shows up
at the end.
At the end. Mm-hmm.
I thought this was random. I was thinking about this. I've thought of it before, but I was reminded of it. I want your input.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Voldemort would have actually been able to steal the Sorcerer's Stone if Harry had not shown up. Because Dumbledore mentioned how only someone who sought the stone but didn't want to use it would be able to acquire it.
Yeah. No, if that's... I think that was the whole point of the protections they had. But, of course, the book would have been very different.
I don't know. Right.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's kind of a common trope in stories and yeah. movies where...
I mean, I have some thoughts on it. I want to hear what you want to say first.
No, I feel like it's a kind of a common trope where when you watch a movie or you read a book and you're like, you know, if they would have just kept their nose out of it or if they would have just done what I would have done, everything would have been okay.
The one thing I hated in the book and the movie is they say, right before like he goes to go confront Voldemort, he tells Hermione, like, go back, get Ron, and go send an owl to Dumbledore. I'm like, why didn't you just send an owl, like, earlier? Like, you could have sent an owl and still done all this, but he would have been coming.
Yeah.
Like,
but you see that often. I mean, that's just part of the storytelling. It's like they're going to make that mistake so that you can have the story. Because if they didn't make the mistake, the story would be a lot more clear cut.
Sometimes they just write it off as they were 11-year-olds. And
that too, yeah.
But... I think it's probably a little too late. Let me start over. On this podcast, we rarely ever give spoiler warnings because we just assume that everybody who is listening knows enough. But because this is the first in the series, we're probably going to be talking about some things that happen later in the series. And so if that's going to bother you, then consider that. Because I'm definitely going to talk about some things that happen later in the series.
Yeah.
So there will be some spoilers in this episode. Maybe it's a little too late to say some of that, but...
I think I stopped giving spoiler, the warning.
But I think because this one's a series, yeah. I think I feel like we need to give a spoiler warning for this one. Like, if somebody has not read this series and wants to be surprised...
Go and read it.
Please, go read it. If you don't care that I'm going to spoil some things, then great, come and join us, right?
Yes.
My response... I wanted to get your input on that one first, but... After reading, because it makes more sense when you read the book, the movie's a little different.
Yes.
I'm just going to jump into it. Because you've read them and you've seen them all.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know later on you find out that Dumbledore's kind of, in a weird way, using Harry?
Yes.
To essentially defeat Voldemort and everything. Like, he loves Harry. Like, he's not a bad guy. But he is, in a weird way, this whole time kind of using Harry to get, like, maneuver him and get things done, and
yeah,
because he knows that he has, like, Harry's only one, kind of. Well, for all intents and purposes, he's the only one.
And there is another Skywalker.
Yeah, stuff. And so knowing that, I think he needed Harry to face Voldemort in this one. Like, that's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah.
Because it makes some sense, because the way it's kind of dragged out a bit, and the fact that Dumbledore knew the whole time what was happening and was, like, helping Harry along the way. Like, it even mentioned that, like, Dumbledore, like, made sure that Harry knew everything he needed to. Like, he gave him, like, he made sure he knew about Wizard's Chess. He made sure that Harry had the invisibility cloak. He made sure that, you know, all these things. Because they were things that he needed to know. But they even make out that point about, how interesting and weird it is that Harry found the Mirror of Erised and he understood the mirror from Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And then Dumbledore, like, hides the mirror away. Right? But, like, he's very upfront with Harry about the mirror and everything.
Yeah.
And so, like, somebody was saying that it was, like, Dumbledore preparing him for the encounter in the end.
Could have been. Yeah. I'm not quite seeing it, but I could see how it was. It could be, because I usually don't lean towards conspiracy theories in general.
Well, I don't know if it's a conspiracy theory so much, because I don't even think it's...
No, I don't mean it that way. Yeah. I'm just saying,
in general, I don't think it was, like, Dumbledore planned that this encounter would happen so much as, like, if the encounter would happen, he wanted Harry to be ready.
And that's what I'm more inclined to say. When I make that statement about conspiracy theories, what I'm really getting at is that I usually tend to take the track of there, some people will look at something and say there's a cabal that's organizing everything. In this case, Dumbledore, who's manipulating every single little moment and is aiming towards this. I like how you put it better, and I think that's a better way of looking at it, is that Dumbledore knew he was the chosen one, the Highlander. Just kidding. And sorry, throwing all my references today. And so Dumbledore knew that there was going to be things that he was going to have to face or things that he would have to go through. So why not prepare him as best he could? I'd have to listen to the whatever you listen to regarding prepping him for this, because I'm not quite seeing how he would be needed to, like, why couldn't Dumbledore have been down there to have defeat Quirrell at the end?
Because I don't think Dumbledore knew it was Quirrell.
So he was using him as the bait.
I don't even think it was bait. Mm-hmm. I mean, later on in the series, it kind of ends up being that way a little bit.
Yeah. But,
I don't think it was so much that, but I think, like, Dumbledore obviously knows that Voldemort is going after the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah.
Because he removes it from Gringotts.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how Dumbledore knows that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we ever find out why Dumbledore knows that.
No, I don't think so.
It's not really important, but we know that. And so they purposefully set up a place for it at Hogwarts.
Mm.
And you know it's recently because he makes an announcement at the beginning of the school year as if it's brand new to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the teachers had just done this, all mm-hmm. the safety measures and everything, right, to guard it. And so I think he knows that Voldemort's going to come after it.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't know how or when. And so knowing what he does know about Harry, I think he was just kind of preparing him.
Okay.
And I don't think he knew it was going to be Quirrell. But he knew it was coming.
He knew it was someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just, there was an enemy in the ranks,
like,
he knew that
he knew that Voldemort couldn't do it on his own because mm-hmm. of the state he'd be in.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I think even in the beginning, Hagrid does a very good job in both movies, but I think more in the book, of saying, oh no, he's still out there. Like mm-hmm. he can't be gone, like, with everything that he's done and selling his soul and everything, like, like, there's no way he's not gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But before we go too much more in depth on that one, I wanted to backtrack slightly. So the Chris Columbus, the director of the movie, and the rest of the creative team, they had to, even though they had input with J.K. Rowling,
mm-hmm.
And in some ways, according to her, there were things that were very close to what she imagined,
mm-hmm.
specifically Diagon Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently she came on set and saw it and, like, almost cried because it was what she imagined.
Yeah.
But other than that, the team had to come up with everything from scratch.
Oh, wow.
Like, you have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she says it's a castle,
mm-hmm.
but there are so many types of castles.
Yeah.
And, like sometimes you get something like, she wore green robes, but, like, what does that look like?
Yeah.
Like, it's really up to artistic interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like how fleshed out it felt in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even, like, one specific example is Maggie Smith went to the costume designer in regards to McGonagall. And it was Maggie Smith's idea to make McGonagall Scottish.
Oh.
Because she knew the name was Scottish.
Yeah.
And she wanted to lean into that.
Yeah.
And so she asked the costume designer if she could make the costume look more Scottish.
Hmm.
And so that's why, specifically, her hat mm-hmm. looks like a Scottish tam.
Oh. I never mm-hmm. paid attention to that.
Yeah, when you look at it, it looks like the normal witch hat, but, like, the way that it's formed, and then, like, it's got that bit that rests and stuff on her forehead.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that stuff. So, like all the goblins in Gringotts look different from each other. They all had fleshed out characters and things like that. And, like, even, like, with the castle, like, it was funny because they actually were trying to find as many real life places as possible
to film in. I remember watching.
And they didn't want to rely on CGI and stuff because they knew they'd have to use it for a lot of stuff anyway, but they wanted to film in a lot of real places. And they even almost filmed the Great Hall in a real Great Hall. But it just didn't quite fit what they wanted to do. And so they built one.
Yeah.
Which is huge. And they were saying part of that is because they really wanted to ground a lot of the magic in reality. Yeah. And they wanted, like, they wanted it to be tangible and real. And like, they knew there'd be a lot of, they wanted to find that balance between realism and like over the top magic and stuff. Cause I will say one thing I noticed in reading the book in this time around is I think Hogwarts in the book is far more chaotic and comical.
Yeah, it is.
Than in the movie.
Yeah. The singing sorting hat. And...
Yes. And like, you know, the suits of armor talking to each other and things like that.
Yeah.
And like random things. One big difference though is the moving staircases in the movie. Cause that's not really in the book, right? You know, like in the movie they mention they specifically move around on them and you see them moving. And like that's the reason why in the movie they end up in the third floor corridor, which is different than the book.
Yeah, that was a plot device. But I don't remember.
I was looking for it in the book. I did not find it.
That's maybe why I didn't pick up on it.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it.
It does talk about how there was like a grand staircase. But it never mentions anything about them moving.
Interesting.
Yeah. It does talk, I think it's on theme with the book.
Yeah.
Because it does talk about how like there are weird staircases and like things that lead to places that are different on other days and things. But I think the movie kind of changed it and like created like a one solid place.
Okay. I did not pick up on that.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah. There's a lot of things it's funny cause I forgot how long the movie is.
Yeah. It is a pretty long movie.
Especially for like a quote unquote kids movie. I thought it was going to be under 2 hours and it was like 2.5 hours and I could have gone 3.
Yep. I think it was 2:22 if I remember right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously one of the biggest differences is the movie had to cut things to fit within the 2 hours.
Yeah.
And a half, I guess. And the book goes much greater in detail.
Oh, yeah.
About how the world and the magic works. And that's the true for anything that has to get condensed.
Yeah, there's that, and they make the background characters background.
In the movie?
In the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Especially Neville. Poor Neville.
Oh, poor Neville. His character got cut so much.
He did.
This is a little random, but I thought it was interesting. I think you might like it. I don't know who this is. I just screenshot it. I'm unfortunately can't remember. Some woman named Susan Hall wrote that there is no rule of law in the books, as the actions of the Ministry of Magic officials are unconstrained by laws, apparently. I don't think that's entirely true. I think there are laws they do pass.
Yeah.
I think I know where she's coming from, but it says the officials are unconstrained by laws, accountability, or any kind of legal challenge, which, again, I don't agree with. I think we see that in later books.
Yeah.
Maybe she's referring just to the first one. I'm not sure. But anyway, it said that this provides an opportunity for Voldemort to offer his own horrific version of order. As a side effect, Harry and Hermione, who were brought up in the highly regulated Muggle world, find solutions by thinking in ways unfamiliar to wizards. For example, Hermione notes that one obstacle to finding the Philosopher's Stone is a test of logic rather than magical power, and that most wizards have no chance of solving it. And I do remember that in the book.
Yeah, because they have more challenges.
Like, I don't agree with everything she said. But I do think that there is a certain amount of illogicalness in the wizarding world. And so it does make sense. Because she does point that out at that point in the book for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to have to read more upon that for the next time we do.
Right. So did you know Alan Rickman was handpicked to play Snape by J.K. Rowling?
I did not know that.
He received special instructions from her about the character. She even provided him with vital details of Snape's backstory, not revealed until the very last novel.
I know he did read the books.
Well, he read the books, but she specifically told him things about the last book, like about his character.
Oh.
That way, from the very beginning, he would know.
Okay.
And so he carried that with him through all the movies.
Yeah, because I mean, I didn't know that part, but I know about the books because I remember Gary Oldman made a comment
yeah. Yeah.
about how he wished he would have read the books like Alan Rickman did, because he's very unhappy with the way he performed in the movie, basically.
I also don't like some of the his choices.
Yeah.
I think I can see why you would not want to read the books, just because maybe you want to bring your own thing to it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think if it's such a phenomenon, I think maybe you should. It's hard. I think I would go if the director wanted me to,
mm-hmm.
then I would. If the director told me, do not read this,
mm-hmm.
then that's something else, you know? But if it's up to you, what was I going to say? But if you think about that, about how Alan Rickman knew about all that,
mm-hmm.
it actually makes a lot of sense in some of his choices in acting.
Mm.
Especially the first time he sees Harry in the Great Hall.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of it, because like one of the things that's not outlined in the book. So one of the things I read about, I noticed in the difference between the two is how in this book, Snape very much is helping Harry. And it's because he's paying back a debt
from the
father saving his life. Is
Dumbledore,
that what it was?
I think it was Quirrell or Dumbledore? It doesn't matter. One of them said that, I guess at one point, Harry's father had saved Snape's life.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, they were, like, enemies. Like, mm-hmm. they hated each other. Like, and he said specifically, it's like how Harry and Draco are.
Yes.
Which is a good point to make.
Which I would even argue that, in this case, Harry's father was more like Draco.
I think the movies paint him much more negatively than the books.
That's what I'm curious to see how the rest of the books...
I remember coming across that scene in the movie, the later movies, where mm-hmm. I'm like, they made him a lot more of a bully in the movie.
He was horrible.
But I don't remember him being that bad in the books.
Yeah.
We'll have to get to that. But it doesn't matter. But I think they're saying that now, because Snape has saved like Harry's life,
mm-hmm.
like he doesn't have to feel like obliged to Harry's father.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but I think that you see that in the movie. You see it happening in the movie when you know it's like eventually. I don't know if it's ever actually, I don't even think it's ever outlined, but I kind of wonder if that was like something that J.K. Rowling told Alan Rickman.
Well, the one thing I know that she told him specifically that's talking about, mm-hmm. and again, spoilers for anybody,
yeah,
is that Snape loved Harry's mother,
yeah, of course,
and like the whole bit about how like the whole reason why he turned away from Voldemort was to protect her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he knew that Voldemort was going to come after her.
Yeah.
And so, like, all of that and everything that went down.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when he sees Harry, like, he sees Lily's eyes.
Yeah.
Like, apparently that was what it's supposed to be. But, like, he looks so much like Harry's dad that he hates him.
Mm.
Like, that's the idea that you get later on in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that was what she was telling him. I think she was telling him all that stuff about Lily, mm-hmm. but then I think she was also telling him the backstory in regards to Voldemort and like his mm-hmm. relationship with Voldemort and how he betrayed Voldemort and so on and so forth.
Okay.
I think she told him all of that.
Yeah.
Because that was very important to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
One other big change I noticed, and I missed this. I love Harry in the movie. He's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Harry in the book is so snarky. And sarcastic, and he will like talk back,
yeah,
to his like authority figures mm-hmm. if he feels they deserve it.
So I wasn't going to bring this up until later books, but when I brought up, what was her name, Lyra or Lila, whatever it is from the Pullman books,
Lyra from Golden Compass.
One of the things that was, Lyra from the Golden Compass, is that Harry starts getting on my nerves as the books go on.
What you mean when he becomes a teenager?
When he becomes a teenager. I remember reading, I don't know if it was a Half-Blood Prince and the Deathly Hallows, but I remember reading them both and just disliking him.
I think, I get where you're coming from. I think that's the biggest difference between reading it when you're older.
Yeah.
And reading it at the same age as Harry.
Yes,
that's one thing that J.K. Yeah. Rowling had said specifically that she actually really enjoyed
mm-hmm.
about writing the books is the idea, the fact that these kids are growing up with these characters,
mm-hmm.
and so there's that relatability on one level,
And then just that growing up aspect. Like, she knew going in that these kids were going to have to grow up in the books.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was prepared for that. And I think in some ways she's actually very accurate to growing up with, like, how they, the choices they make and the stupid things they do.
I'm looking forward to rereading the other books because, I, like I said, it's been 20 years. Yeah. It's been a while since I've read the last four.
And I think you will not hate them as much in the book.
Okay, because I one of the things I think a lot of authors do badly is a lot of authors are not real good at writing kids. And so because this is her, this is what she did. And I mean,
what was her first book?
It was her first book, but still she maybe, I don't know how much she took from her own kid, but, or if it was from her own people she knew or whatever, but she's one of the many, one of the few authors who wrote kids really well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so now that you mention it like that, and I kind of thought about it as I was reading it back in the day. But I'm really curious to see how the books are going to come across.
Well, you know what? I think one of the reasons why I think she writes the children well is because they're not flat.
No, they're not.
Remember when we were talking about Matilda?
Mm-hmm.
How a lot of the kids like had weird quirks and stuff, but they all felt the same?
Yes.
She's not like that.
Yeah.
You read these books and they all feel like real people.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're still children. And so like they're going to be dumb and they're gonna be like shallow at times and stuff, but they all feel real. Like Draco does not act like Harry, and Harry does not act like Hermione, and Ron, and but even then, like background characters like Seamus and Dean and even Jordan and you know, whoever, like all these background characters, they feel real.
Yeah, that was what I missed in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is because they became two dimensional. Well, 'cause
you had to cut them down.
I understand that, but I think there could have been a way in which they could have added a little bit more. Like, I understand, like for instance, all the lines that were taken away from Neville and Jameis and
were like Jordan, put in other characters' mouths.
And they were, yeah, and even like from Hagrid, they gave, I think, Hermione a lot of the lines.
Has like a whole like character development.
Yeah, but I think that that's the one area in which I wish they could have done it a little bit better, because there are shows and movies in which the background characters are more than just background. Like, they may shine for just one scene, but you can still show that, you know? I mean, I don't know how they would have done it.
I think it's okay. I think Chris Columbus does well enough with all of that.
Okay.
I think later directors don't do as well.
Mm.
Especially when you find out that they're not reading the book. And then they're and like they're totally like not including things they need to include for later books,
yeah,
or later movies. But one of the things I noticed about the movie is it really, because it's visual, it heavily emphasizes and sometimes dramatizes or exaggerates a lot of the magical parts.
Yeah,
and so some of the more realistic like character type stuff is kind of sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it has great characters in the movie, but like the wider range of side characters and stuff definitely get sacrificed.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like in the movie, like the Quidditch scene is huge and it's all over the place and it's dramatic and it's violent and it's really cool flying and all these things, but it's actually a lot simpler in the book.
Like they have rules in the book.
When
the
movie's not drawn out as much. It's not drawn out as much.
Yes,
in the book. And even like the troll scene in the bathroom doesn't feel as long in the book. And a lot of the attention to detail in a lot of the magical scenes in the book is far less than in the movie.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's visual, so it makes
sense. And so like it makes sense. No, you're right. It makes sense because that was, for me, the Quidditch scene was one of the more...
In the movie or the book?
In the movie, it was a lot more... It was more dramatic and spectacular.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
I want to kind of go in a little bit in chronological order.
Next time on Willing to Adapt.
I specifically sat down, and as I read the book, I wrote down every change that I noticed from the book to the movie. And so I'm not going to go into every detail, because this would be a very long podcast.
Yes.
But it did remind me, I had this idea in my head that the movie was almost like a direct remake or like adaptation.
Yeah.
And then as I'm reading the book, I realized how different it actually was.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what Professor Quirrell was trying to accomplish with jinxing Harry's broom. Because Harry really would not have been in any danger at all because he's in public.
Yeah.
There's so many people who could, like, do magic and save him from falling or whatever, you know. In the book, Ron is not as cowardly.
Yeah.
But because a lot of the bits with Neville got cut, and then they got kind of switched to Ron, in the movie, Ron comes off a lot more cowardly.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review, or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.